for those of you who don't know Bhagavati, she's a wonderful educator in homeopathy. She's a registered nurse and a CCH. She is a graduate of Harvard University. She graduated Phi Beta Kappa in 1974. And for the last 30 years, she's been involved in different aspects of holistic health care. She did own a health food store in Massachusetts for 16 years, and that's where she first began to work with homeopathic remedies. And I think her first formal introduction was in 1995 with Dr. Luc de Schepper, and I think she helped him to co-found the Renaissance Institute of Classical Homeopathy in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She's also been the editor for a number of books, including The People's Repertory by Dr. Luc de Schepper, Hahnemann Revisited, as well as Yasgur's Dictionary, which is world-renowned. She lectures at the homeopathy at the Massachusetts College of Pharmacy, and she's co-authored the chapter on homeopathy in the American Pharmacological Association's Handbook of Non-Prescription Drugs. She's also lectured on homeopathy at Northeastern University School of Pharmacy and MGH Institute's training program for nurse practitioners. Currently, Bhagavati has her own school in Massachusetts called Teleosis. And let me just tell you a quick little story. I was invited last month to do a presentation on some cases at her school for her students. And I can honestly say that the caliber of education, the level of understanding for these second and third year students was really quite astonishing. I travel all over the world and teach and present cases and demonstrate radar, and I can honestly say that these were some of the best trained students at this level that I've ever seen. So that's a real testimony to the efficacy of her school and her program and what she's done. And I can speak from firsthand experience because she was very, she really did due diligence with me in terms of making sure that I provided information that would be both useful to the students and valuable and also appropriate for their level of learning. So thank you so much for joining us, Bhagavati.
Well, thank you, and thanks for saying that, Kim, about the school. And I want to say right off the bat that I feel like I'm mostly an administrator and coordinator of other teachers, and I feel so incredibly lucky to have people teaching with me who are much more experienced educators than me, beginning with Paris Gums, who really co-founded the school with me, and she has spent many years studying how people learn. It's really the core of what I'll be talking about tonight, how to enhance the effectiveness of learning. And Loretta Butehorn, who spoke at the NCH conference in April, she's a PhD in adult education and a homeopath in the Boston area who's the co-director of the school. Simon Taffler, who comes in from London to teach for us, he's about to get, as far as we know, the world's first PhD in homeopathic education. So I feel surrounded by people who are just so thoughtful and so careful about the educational process, and I want to give them all the credit for all the wonderful things you just said about our school.
Okay.
Thank
and
you.
Listen,
Kim.
Later on, I'm going to ask you to give for the people who are on the call to just give them some more information about the school, the website, and stuff. But I'll ask you about that
Sure.
before we end. Okay.
Sure.
So you had been the one who had decided on the subject of the call tonight, which was on learning or education in homeopathy, and I know that you've were involved in education before you got involved in homeopathy. I was curious if you could tell us a little bit about that first.
Oh, sure. Well, I was thinking about how people learn and how to learn more effectively, actually from my undergraduate days. As you mentioned, I was lucky enough to go to Harvard, and one of the wonderful things about studying at Harvard is that, in general, for any particular course, the person teaching it is a lot of times the world's greatest expert in that particular field, or at least one of the top experts, often the person who wrote the textbook. So on the one hand, the great thing is that you have this great expert teaching the class, and the not-so-great thing is that a lot of times that person is really actually not a very good teacher. And in fact, the best teaching, the best learning that I experienced at Harvard was often not in the classroom. It was either work I was doing on my own studying and research and so forth, or working in small groups with a few other students, with a graduate student, or just learning from my fellow students. You know, people in my classroom had done really interesting things in their lives outside of the classroom, and I learned a lot from them. So that kind of got me started with this idea that the person who's the expert is not always necessarily the best teacher. You know, the whole idea that somebody who's really an expert, a lot of times, like, they're so good at what they do that they do it almost intuitively, and they don't necessarily have the ability to explain to a beginner what they're doing. And sometimes the person who can explain the best is somebody who's very consciously and thoughtfully and reflectively gone through the experience in a way that they can articulate for somebody else. So that was kind of the beginnings of my thinking about it, and I kind of put that on hold for quite a few years. As you mentioned, I had a health food store. Truly unusual career path to go from Harvard to a health food store, but I had thought I was going to be a doctor like my dad, and I just got involved in alternative medicine when I was at Harvard, and I just never looked back, you know, never went to medical school, and I had this profound commitment to alternative medicine from an early age, so there was nothing like naturopathic school then, there were no homeopathic schools then, so I opened a health food store and kind of learned on the job. But towards the end of that time, I was invited to a series of weekend seminars by this wonderful, wonderful teacher named Dr. Donna Markova. And her work really, really changed my life, really influenced my life for good. In these seminars, it was with a small group of perhaps anywhere from 12 to 20 people. And she taught us how to learn, not by lecturing, but by creating for us a series of experiences that we would have, that we would do individually or in small groups or perhaps as a whole group. She would lead us through a series of exercises and experiences in which we'd have a chance to reflect on different things and come up with, kind of arrive at the truth that she was hoping to impart to us, but we'd arrive at it on our own. So we really and truly got it in a way that we wouldn't have gotten it from hearing her lecture. And at the same time, from hearing all the different people in the class kind of chime in with their own experiences, we could see the same truth from different angles. And it kind of, it imparted a sense of not so much a dogmatic and rigid right and wrong kind of truth, but rather this wonderful multifaceted, like a beam of light shining through a prism that then becomes reflected in different colors. You know, it's very interesting to me as a bit of an egghead to hear other people in the group who were intellectuals, very bookish like me, would tend to have somewhat similar insights as me. But then there were other people in the group who might be, someone might be a dancer, someone might make pottery or do very different things with their life than me, who would have totally different insights so much from. And I realized how much I could learn from people who didn't necessarily have the intellectual pedigree that I had. So it was a very, really humbling and heart-expanding experience for me to realize how much I could learn from other people of all different backgrounds. So, again, a profoundly transformative experience. And Donna has written, I want to really recommend to the listeners, I want to really highly recommend, if people want to learn more effectively, I'd say the first and best thing to do is to understand how you learn in terms of what Donna Markova taught us. It's in a couple of books. One is called Think Ability. That's available from Amazon. That's her current book. I learned from one that's out of print now, but it would be available from one of the online, you know, used booksellers. It was called How Your Child is Smart. And the idea of it is that all of us are smart, but we're all smart in different ways. Donna Markova had taken Milton Erickson's idea of visual, auditory, and kinesthetic kind of perceptual processing patterns in our brains. She took that idea and she took it to, I'd say, a much higher level that's much more subtle, sophisticated, and kind of all-embracing. And the basic idea is this. I want to explain it because I feel it's really important for understanding how we can learn homeopathy. You'll see this has very practical applications. So the idea is that all of us have visual, auditory, and kinesthetic aspects of our mental processing. There's one of those ways that we use, let's say, to concentrate, to learn discrete bits of information, to focus on things, to interface with the world in a very linear, concrete kind of way. So, for example, in my case, that's visual. So if I want to study something and learn a lot of information, I would read a book and I would kind of learn it almost in a photographic kind of way. So that's why I get discrete bits of information. There's another part of our brain that's the nonlinear, the creative and expansive, free-flowing, spiraling, nonlinear, almost somewhat trance-like, very deep, intimate, sensitive, sacred part of ourselves. It's a very different part, which in my case is kinesthetic. So, for example, when I'm out there moving my body like biking or running or gardening, that's when I'm writing poetry or I'm envisioning the future of the school and coming up with these great, vast plans for what's possible with homeopathy in this very nonlinear part of my brain. The third aspect is the one that connects those two, the one in the middle. In my case, it's auditory. This is the part that processes, that sorts, that goes back and forth between the very specific focus on the outer world and this inner kind of nonlinear, creative inner reality. So there's the third part of our brain that's kind of sorting, processing, mulling over, humming, you know, like maybe this, maybe that, making choices, making decisions. For me, when I have to mull something over, I like to talk to someone about maybe it's this, maybe it's that, maybe I'll do this, maybe that. And if I don't have a person to talk to, then I'm kind of talking to myself, either out loud or in my mind. That's the auditory processing part of myself. And this is, for example, totally different from my dad, who is an auditory learner, like his, let's say we all learn in all three ways, but he gets information auditorily, he can listen to books on tape, and then he can recite like whole paragraphs of these books, whereas if I listen to something on tape, it goes in one ear and out the other. My mom says that my dad got through medical school, he's dyslexic, he got through medical school because she would read the textbooks to him and he would memorize stuff from hearing it read. So this is just, you know, a different way of learning. And that's why I think, since we're different, it's really important for students, and, you know, I'm encouraging the listeners to try to identify what your particular learning style is, which you can do with one of these books. The other really important concept I got from Donna Markova was the idea of active learning, that to really and truly get something and make it your own, you have to actively work with what you're learning. She uses a simple concept of inhale and exhale. Inhale is like you're taking in the information. Exhale is you're expressing it in some way. You might turn to the student next to you, you know, and just summarize what you just learned, or you might tell somebody about a book you just read. So these are simple examples of exhaling. You know, you might write down for yourself a summary of the book or the lecture. But what I learned from Donna is that for learning to be really deep and really true and really become a part of yourself, it has to involve all three, the auditory, the kinesthetic, the visual, and it has to involve all three, both as you inhale and as you exhale. So that's really informed, you know, the way I've tried to design the classroom at Teleosis. So that's kind of the background of, you know, as you said, what I did with education before I even discovered homeopathy.
Could you spell the last name, Donna Markova's last name?
Yeah, sure. It's M-A-R-K-O-V-A.
Okay, M-A-R-K-O-V-A.
M-A-R-K-O-V-A. Donna is D-A-W-N-A. And again, Paris Gums, who's helped me kind of dream the school into existence, had worked with Donna Markova for many years. And Annie Powell, who is her co-author and co-seminar leader, is a consultant to the school. I'm very, very grateful for that we've had her insights into how to set up a better learning environment in the school.
So, Bhagavati, how did you begin incorporating this stuff into homeopathy? How did that happen?
I started thinking about it right from the first day. From the first day I started studying homeopathy professionally, I remember, you know, listening to this lecture, and within about 2 hours, I remember thinking, oh, my God, here I am. I'm 43 years old, and I have found my life work. I have found my passion in life. I have found what I'm here on earth to do. I have found my mission. I have found homeopathy, like many people do when they discover homeopathy and just totally fall in love with it. So that was like my first 2 hours. By 2 hours later, I was saying to myself, isn't there a better way to teach this? Because basically we were beginning students listening to a lecture and listening to all these, you know what it's like when you first start learning homeopathy, all these Latin names, you can't even spell them, so how can you possibly take notes? And you have the feeling that it's probably all written down in a book somewhere anyway. So immediately I began dreaming, like, how can we do this better? And I had the chance to try that a few years later with a small group of about 20 students. I did a series of seminars on remedies for mental and emotional chief complaints. And so I had a chance to implement these ideas. I broke them up into small groups, and I found from experience that usually to do really good active learning, you want to have a group of two, maybe three, but by the time you get a group of four, usually at that point, one person is dominating, and at least one person is kind of hanging back and listening, and that person isn't really doing a whole lot of active learning. So I had small groups, and I gave each one of them a remedy name, and I had them do bubble charts. And bubble charts are one of my favorite ways of having students learn remedies. So I'm going to try to describe it. In a bubble chart, you take a great big piece of paper, and it's more fun if you have great big, fat, different colored magic markers, and you write the name of the remedy in the middle, and then you study the remedy, and you come up with a few themes, maybe 3 to 6 themes for the remedy. And then you write each one in a bubble, like it looks like a balloon around the, you know, the central remedy, and connect it to the remedy. So it's kind of like spokes on a wheel. But then it gets more fun than that, because what you want to do before you put magic marker to paper, what you want to do is think about how are the themes connected and how can you create a sense of the connection between the themes themselves. So you end up with this kind of wonderfully non-linear kind of map of what the remedy is about. and I'll give you a really simple example of that. One of the first ones I did was of Lachesis, and let's face a couple of really obvious themes. One is sexuality, and one is kind of suspicion and paranoia. So in themselves, these are themes for Lachesis. Well, you can connect them with the theme of jealousy, you know, sexual jealousy, where the person is suspicious that their partner is cheating on them. So what you can do is you can have the students first figure out these major themes, and then they could write in, you know, proving symptoms or particular rubrics under each one, and then in the connections between them, write in the proving symptoms or the rubrics that connect each one. So you end up with these kind of maps of the remedies. The major themes are pretty simple to remember, so you kind of have a manageable chunk. And that's one of the things you want to do, is instead of overwhelming the students with materia medica, just have a manageable chunk. So I actually had two different groups do each remedy on different sides of the room, so I couldn't hear each other working. Then we had them tape up their charts up front at the end with the pairs, you know, next to each other, so we could look at how two different groups did the same remedy. And it's really interesting because the different maps that they made or charts of the remedies, they're very similar. Of course, there's a lot of consensus, but there were things that were different, too. So that gave us a whole other level of stuff to chew over, like, you know, you kind of get away from the idea, again, of this dogmatic right and wrong, like there's one right way to do it. You see that this other group did something slightly different, and you think, oh, you know, do I like what they did? Maybe better than what I did, or is there some justification for what they did? And you start working with the material, again, very actively learning, working with the material in a different way. And then you have the students think about, why would people come up with different, you know, why is it? It kind of leads into the question of why is it that when you read about a remedy in different books, different authors are going to give you slightly different versions of it? And, you know, one of the answers we came up with is that, you know, there are cultural differences or differences in the client population. You know, a homeopath writing in India is going to see perhaps a different type of patient. Perhaps in Vitulkas in Greece or Bailey writing in Australia. Sometimes I read Bailey's homeopathic psychology and I think, God, people must be pretty different in Australia because I never see people from the, you know, with this remedy type presenting.
Oh, I
like
totally
this.
Agree with you.
You agree with me?
Totally.
And here's a simple example we came up with was we're thinking about aurum and how it's used for people who are depressed and suicidal and thinking, you know, perhaps in some future dream world where homeopathy is the standard of care, so all the hospitals and all the clinics are homeopathic, and not only that, every high school has a homeopathic guidance counselor, on-the-spot therapist for the kids, and every mental hospital, every jail, every nursing home, every suicide hotline has a homeopath as part of their staff. How would a homeopath working with a student population seeing aurum in these very intellectual, competitive high school students perceive aurum differently than somebody working in a nursing home who sees somebody who's very depressed because his wife, he's been married for 50 years and his wife has died and he's very depressed. And how would these two different homeopaths say, what's the most important chief complaint on the physical plane? You know, somebody looking at high school students might say acne, which is definitely there, you know, an aurum. And somebody working with the elderly might say cardiac conditions, which is there too. You know, they're both different aspects. Like this image of the beam of light shining through the prism and coming out with different colors. You know, you can have different perceptions of the same thing. So anyway, that was my kind of my preliminary experience was I actually had the chance to teach a few weekends and to see how much the students appreciated this very active learning, you know, how much they were able to get the remedies from this very active learning.
You know, but I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I think another thing that's really useful about this is it helps people not to pigeonhole the remedies into looking, you know, one specific way and only that way. I think that's one of the values of doing it in that manner, to see that these remedies really are multifaceted.
Yes, and that was one of the higher levels of learning that I wanted the students to get from this.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt you.
That's okay. Yeah. So I continued dreaming. I did not at that point have a school. I worked as the administrator of Dr. Luke's school for a while, but I did not yet have my own school. And Paris and I were dreaming of our dream school. How do we create the ideal classroom environment? And then I went to New York to a conference organized by Joel Kreisberg, who is head of the Council on Homeopathic Education. And his whole purpose was to help homeopaths, you know, people from homeopathic schools to teach better, drawing on what is known from this vast body of knowledge. And, you know, people get PhDs in education. There's the Harvard Graduate School of Education right here. There's a lot that's known about how people learn and how to teach better. So immediately I felt that Joel was a kindred spirit. I was very excited to meet him, and I learned more things from Joel. many things. I'll just share one thing I learned from him, which is that in each school you're imparting three basic types of things to the students. There's knowledge, skills, and attitudes. And Joel said in most homeopathic schools, most of what's being imparted is knowledge. You know, there's so much to learn about, you know, thousands of remedies in each one, so many keynotes and so forth. There's a lot of, let's say, stuff, a lot of data. And much of homeopathic schooling is simply, you know, lecturing where one expert is transmitting that to the students or kind of sitting there copying it down. But he said, honestly, that's better, just learn from the students reading books on their own. How much better to devote classroom time to the skills that are needed. And think of what a really wide array of skills are needed to be a good homeopath. There's definitely intellectual skills, knowledge of the remedies, and then there's, you know, how to take a good case, how to interview someone, how to elicit the information that will be helpful in a reasonable amount of time in an interview, how to extract from that the most, you know, what are the juicy parts? What are the pearls that you really want to base your case on? How do you find good rubrics? Repertorizing, how do you choose which of the remedies that come up do you actually want to learn more about or read more about to do your differential, you know, not necessarily the one that comes up number one. And then think of how much is needed in case management to evaluate all the different reasons why someone could come back and say, nothing happened, or I feel worse, or I think it's not working, or whatever. So there's a lot of things you have to know for that type of skill, but then there are people skills, like how do you make someone feel comfortable in an interview? How do you make them feel comfortable when you have to ask them about, like, really pretty difficult, tricky things? And then kind of ongoing, how do you deal with patients who are angry? How do you deal with patients who are who disappear, who are non-compliant? How do you deal with patients who are complaining? So there's so many different types of things that a homeopath has to know how to do. Why not spend a lot of classroom time practicing that? And again, it becomes very active learning, where you have the students role-playing, you have the students doing skits, you have the students pretending. I remember in the first year we had the students pretending that one was the homeopath and one was the patient coming in, and the homeopath had to do a little mini interview for an acute case. It was so empowering for them. And we had them, you know, demonstrate in front of the class that one of the students introduced herself to the mock patient. The mock homeopath said, hello, I'm Dr. So-and-so. And you could tell how she just felt so good about being in this role of a healthcare provider. So it was kind of moving the students towards a sense of empowerment. So anyway, skills. Joel taught me the importance of skills. And then he said, attitude. Every school teaches attitudes, but most schools are not aware of it. And it helps to be aware of what attitude you're imparting to your students. It helps to be very conscious and decide what attitudes you want to impart and then how are you going to impart them in your classroom. And he said, unfortunately, a lot of schools impart the attitude that from the teacher imparts the attitude, my way is the best way, my way is the only way, everybody else is doing it wrong. And as he pointed out, how are we going to create community among homeopaths if people graduating from schools don't want to have anything to do with people from other schools? So that's one type of attitude that can be imparted. So, you know, in our school, we try to impart a very different attitude, which is a sense of community, sense of plurality, you know, inviting in teachers from who represent different ways of prescribing and so forth. So anyway, that was the story of Joel. So that was kind of a transition for me. First, I learned about Joel and his dream school, and then, to make a long story short, Joel ended up moving from New York to California and kind of passing the school along to me. I moved it to Boston, and I feel so lucky in many ways that Joel basically kind of passed the torch of Tiliosis to me, along with all this wonderful learning I had received from him about how to make an effective classroom.
Very interesting. It sounds, it sounds not only like it's a wonderful program, but it's like a lot of fun as well.
We have total fun.
That really sounds very exciting.
Yeah.
I know that you do a lot of different things in your classroom, and this is so interesting to me. Could you give us some other examples of things that you do in your classroom besides what you've mentioned already?
Sure. Okay, well, here's an example. Here's a simple example, making a remedy. I found that a lot of practicing homeopaths have never actually sat down and made a remedy, and it's quite an experience, you know, to pass around in a class of 30 people, to pass around a little vial where they're dumping all the water out of the vial, maybe one or two drops are clinging to the inside of the vial, and then they're filling it with water and succussing it, and then they pass the whole thing to the next student, you know, to dump out the water except for maybe one drop, and then add more water. By the time you do that 30 times, of course, you have something like a 30C. And people get the concept of the infinitesimal dose by the time they've done that in a way that you could never get it by reading about it, you know? So you have this kinesthetic sense of doing something with your hands, and then the auditory sense of, like, talking about it, sharing what that experience was like. Then, of course, proving a remedy. We always do a proving in each class. So, again, the kinesthetic sense of experiencing the remedy from the inside, noticing, you know, noticing on the inside what's going on. And then the visual part, recording in a proving journal, the auditory part, talking to the proving supervisor, then at the end, you know, collating the results of the proving. And then we worked on it further by having the students, again, in small groups, trying to come up with themes for the remedy we had just proven. And again, looking at how different people could take the same information and come up with slightly different variations on the same themes. So that was a wonderful experience. Again, something you could never get from reading about it, reading about what a proving is like. You never really understand it as you do from actually doing the proving. Another similar thing we did, excuse me, with our recent first-year class was they read about the different Bach flower remedies, and they made their own mixture, their own individual mixtures, and they took them, and they observed what they felt. And this was not exactly a proving. It was more just a noticing, like an energetic, you know, an awareness of energy shifts or things that were changing for them or how they felt, with a focus more on what does it mean to have a sense of well-being, and that leads into a discussion of what's well-being, what's health, what's healing, and trying to come up with a collective definition of what health and healing are. I can say after a few years of nursing school, that's something that was never addressed in allopathic education. You know, that we talked a lot about illness, but never about what does health mean. So doing the Bach flower remedy was, again, a very active kind of learning for them. And then some other things that we did, we do a lot of skits, like to have the students embody the remedies. We have different ways that the students embody the remedies. They can do skits, like let's say, for example, we're studying the salts of sulfur or the salts of natrum, and we can do a little skit in which each student represents a different one, and they create a little scene, like let's say they're all driving in the car together, or they're a family having dinner together, or they're, you know, one student was like they're walking into a bar and talking to the other people at the bar. Different little scenes from everyday life where each person represents a different remedy in this family, and everybody else has to guess. You know, so they're supposed to try to embody it, the feeling of the remedy, perhaps thinking about what gestures, what movement that remedy might use, what words they're going to try to say, something that's a little hint, like a keynote of the remedy, or act out a keynote of the remedy. And again, it's so much fun. We're laughing like anything, laughing like crazy. You remember it very vividly, seeing the students act these things out. And then, so then we try to figure out at the end what it was. You can do variations on that, like do it silently, have the students dance what they imagine it might feel like to be in the energy field of a particular remedy. They could dance it, or they could even try to make a sculpture out of it. So, again, it's part of their act of learning whether or not it's true. You know, the important thing is what they're experiencing on the inside and how they have to really focus on the remedy to try to get the sense of the remedy. Another thing we did was we brought in a bunch of old magazines, and we gave each of the students a remedy that had some really juicy delusions, and they had to find pictures from the magazines to represent the delusions of that remedy, and they glued them together and made a collage, again, of just a very wonderful, vivid, graphic image of the delusions of a remedy that was more vivid for the students who did it because they were actively doing it. Again, something working with their hands. A final thing that we did was we had the students do presentations on research. Each student had to read an original research study because we felt that, you know, when you think about the different skills that are needed to be a good homeopath, the ability to evaluate research on homeopathy is really important, and also the ability to speak to people who are not homeopaths who may say homeopathy is unproven, there's not good research, whatever. We felt that it was very important for students to be able to respond to that. So we had them each read a research study, and then they had a choice to either make a little funny skit out of it, which again, when you have a really dull research study, it helps to make it really funny, which some of them did. And for others, we had them imagine that they were presenting, let's say, to an annual meeting of their professional societies. Like, how would they present this research to their colleagues? Again, very good practice for them. So, I guess I'll just mention one other thing. Having them say, imagine that they were asked, let's say you're asked at a party, what are you doing, what are you up to, it's homeopathy, and you really only have 1 minute of the person's attention span to explain what homeopathy is. It's like, you know, what's called the elevator speech. Explain homeopathy in 1 minute, explain it in 5 minutes, or explain it in 20 minutes, like you've been actually invited to address a particular group, so you have 20 minutes to talk about homeopathy. Giving the students, each student, a chance to practice their own answer to that, again, really helps them to embody that learning, which is learning how to explain homeopathy to people, a very important skill.
Yeah, this is really wonderful. I really want to applaud your commitment to educating the community in this manner, because really a lot of the education, and not just in homeopathy, but everywhere, is what you just mentioned earlier. It's just essentially an instructor standing up in front of a group and reciting a bunch of information, and the people essentially just writing that information down, putting it in a drawer and forgetting about it. And, you know, for me, learning has always been only really useful when the student goes actually through the actual process of discovery in themselves. And so I think I really want to applaud you. I think it's fantastic. Also, you know, this is very much in accordance with what Hahnemann writes about in his Medical Observer article, where he talks about, you know, drawing and the great classical writings and poetry, and basically developing all aspects of our faculties to really be able to even be able to take a case appropriately. So, you know, I think this is just wonderful stuff.
Right. That's a fabulous article, Kim, that you handed out to our students, and maybe you could mention to people how they could access it. Is it on your website?
Actually, that article is posted up on the Whole Health Now website.
Yeah.
So if you go to www.wholehealthnow.com and you just go to What's New, you'll see, I think the article is like third down or something like that. And it is a very excellent article about what you need to master to be able to take a good case, to really observe your patient, to elicit the necessary information to be able to prescribe effectively for them. So, and it totally dovetails with what you're talking about. I mean,
right.
So I know that, you know, you do a lot of work in the classroom situation. Do you also provide homework for the students? And if you do, what do you provide for them? I mean, what do they are they required to do work at home as well?
Yeah, of course. But we call it home play.
Oh,
because we want them to have fun with it. And we want them to get out of the feeling of homework is like a chore, you know, it's like something you're assigned, it's like a drag. We call it home play because we really want them to have fun with it. So we try to create assignments that will help them to think for themselves, to think through things for themselves, often thinking about, you know, how, say, in a different family, a particular family of remedies, how each remedy, for example, the drug remedies, when you came to teach our class the drug remedies, their home play was to reflect on the qualities of the drug family, like what is it about a remedy that makes it a drug remedy, like what are those kind of essential drug remedy, drug family qualities, how does each remedy embody those, and how is it different? You know, how do you differentiate one particular drug remedy from another? And then what is the starting substance, and is there a way in which you can see the starting substance reflected in the qualities of the remedy? So that might be one thing we might have them do at home. They all have tutors, so again, in terms of active learning and being able to exhale, each student has a tutor to get individual feedback on their cases. And in the clinical year, you know, we have a 2-year clinical program.
Can you just tell us a little bit about that? Because I know a lot of schools don't offer that. Could you?
Yeah, you know, I inherited this setup from Joel Kreisberg. And in fact, I took Teleosis myself because I had been asked by many, many students in the previous school that I ran, Dr. Luke DeShepherd's school. Many of the students would say, Bhagavati, we need a clinic. How can we have a profession without a teaching clinic? And many of the students in that school were already professionals, whether it was a psychotherapist, acupuncturist, chiropractor, whatever. And they all said, you know, to be able to practice in our healing modality, you have to have many, many hours, hundreds, maybe even thousands of hours of supervision. How is it possible that in homeopathy, students can go out and practice without taking cases and having feedback from a professional homeopath? So people were begging for this kind of clinic. I kept saying, I don't feel ready to run a clinic like this. Finally asked myself, what do I need to do to feel ready? And I realized the answer was, I have to go to New York and actually take Joel Kreisberg's clinic as a student, even though I had been practicing at that point for 5 years. I learned enormously from it, even though I was already a practicing homeopath. Joel had set up the clinic in a pretty unique way. I think he set it up, again, for maximum active learning of the students and with a lot of faith in the students as mature adult learners. That was another really basic principle that Joel founded Teleosis on, which is that you really have to have faith that the students really want to learn, they're going to take responsibility for their learning, and you know, you don't have to babysit them, basically. So he set up the student clinic where one student would see a real patient. You know, the patients were generally low-income patients that were given the chance to go to a student clinic in exchange for, you know, a very small amount of money or even no money, you know, in the case of, for example, we had homeless people and so forth. So one student would take the case in a small room with a video camera where the rest of the class would watch, and then at the end, the first thing we would do is the student would give it, would have a chance to debrief, you know, what their experience of taking the case was. We'd focus on the case taking itself rather than on the remedy. You know, and there's so many things that need to be considered in case taking, like what question do you begin with? How much time do you spend on the chief complaint? When do you go deep? And when do you pull back from going deep? When do you feel like you, when do you need to push and probe a little further? And when do you need to kind of back off and let the person recover a little bit? And what do you do if the person cries? I mean, these are really, you know, what do you do if the person gets angry? We had one patient who was actually quite threatening to this poor student who was interviewing him. So anyway, these are real life questions that come up. And again, impossible to learn from a book. So first the student gives a self-assessment, how they feel they did, were they comfortable with it, what they wish they'd done differently, what they felt they did well, and then the class has a chance to give them feedback, beginning with very loving and very supportive feedback, because we create this classroom environment where the students, are they're not competing with each other, they're really helping each other out. So then the students would have a chance to say, you know, I really like this question that you asked. I think you handled that difficult topic really well, and here's why. And so the whole class gets to learn, along with the student who is taking the case, about the process of case taking. And then the students break up in small groups and work on figuring out a remedy. So they're all kind of a team working to help the student who took the case on figuring out a remedy. So that's the basic idea. And then the student who took the case is responsible for all the case management. Like the patient calls into that student. The student, if there's anything at all difficult or tricky about the question, the student calls the supervisor. And then the patient comes back for follow-ups into the clinic. The same student sees the patient and gets to deal with all the twists and turns that come up in a real-life case. You know, there's just so many things that happen, beginning with the patient comes back and they never took the remedy for whatever reason. Or they took the remedy, they had a horrible experience, and the student has to really kind of talk them through that and give them a little pep talk about continuing and do some patient education around, you know, what an aggravation means and why in the long run it perhaps it's part of the healing journey. So anyway, that's kind of the basic idea of the student clinic. And we have a two-year program where the students on Saturday do advanced materia medica and kind of more advanced studies, and then on Sunday they do the student clinic. And it's fairly unique, I think, in the sense that not only are students taking the cases, but they're really making the remedy choices. And the role of the supervisor is mostly to give feedback on their process rather than to choose the remedy or even really kind of tilt them toward a particular remedy, unless we really think the student's way off base and we really think the patient is going to, you know, suffer as a result. Of course, the supervisor will intervene. But for the most part, we want the student to get the maximum possible learning from making the choice of the remedy and then really handling all the follow-up themselves.
Bhagavi, how did the school get the name
Chiliosis?
Yeah, where does that come from?
Joel chose it, and I think it was actually a very inspired choice of name. It has resonance on many levels. Chiliosis is a Greek word, and it's a concept kind of like homeostasis. Now, everybody's familiar with homeostasis. Homeostasis is the idea that in every living organism, there's this tendency to come into balance and to reach the optimum. You know, if the blood pressure is too high, to bring it down, if it's too low, to bring it up, to whatever is the optimum for that being. So homeostasis is the tendency of living organisms to come into balance, into harmony. Chiliosis is kind of a parallel thing, but quite different. It's the urge within all living things to grow towards greater evolution, towards greater organization, intelligence, consciousness, self-awareness. Ultimately, it's a concept that ties in with a concept in Eastern philosophy, which is that all of us are here on this planet to become aware of the divinity within ourselves, to realize this highest consciousness within ourselves. That's really the whole goal of evolution on the planet, is for each of us to become aware of that inner divinity. So that concept is embodied in teleosis. It's also a word that's used by George Vitulkis, who, just in case there are listeners who are not aware of Vitulkis, probably widely considered the greatest living homeopath. And Vitulkis uses this word, again, for the urge in living beings towards greater greater awareness, greater growth, you know, greater healing. And teleosis is kind of, in homeopathy, we're trying to support the growth towards teleosis. So that's
fantastic.
Kind of,
I love it.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah.
That's great.
Very special word.
That's great. Where does he mention teleosis? I don't remember seeing
it's
it.
It's in Science of Homeopathy.
Is it in Science of Homeopathy?
Yeah.
It's been such a long time since I read it. But that's
you wouldn't
great.
Really notice it, but I have several quotes from him that use the word teleosis.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it. You know, Bhagavati, I noticed, and you mentioned this also on the call earlier about, you mentioned on the website, in the description of teleosis, about creating a model to embody certain values. And you also mentioned that earlier on the call as well.
Yeah.
Could you make that a little bit more concrete for the people
sure.
listening?
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that because I feel like it's one of the really special things about the school is that we're very conscious of how we set up the classrooms, that the students learn not only homeopathy but certain values. Like I mentioned the idea that we feel that there's not just one right way to practice, that there's more than one right way. You know, people practice homeopathy in very different ways. And on the one hand, we really honor the classical tradition, and the teachers are all very much within the classical tradition. But even within that tradition, people have different, some people use 30 C's or 200s or LMs. You know, some people do follow-ups after a few weeks or other people at a longer time. There are many different ways that people manage their practice. So we invite teachers who practice in very different ways, and the students get exposed to these different ways. Again, breaking down this monolithic idea of one right way and giving the students a whole repertoire that they can draw on when they go out and they have their own practices. So that's one thing that we do. Another thing is that Joel was reflecting on how there's not enough community in homeopathy. Homeopaths tend to practice in isolation. And he consciously set up this classroom design where there's a lot of small group work. And when you work with a small group, you learn how to work with other people, and you learn how much you can learn from other people. And you automatically build in the sense of a peer group resource, so that when the students graduate, automatically they have other homeopaths they can turn to. If they can't figure out a case, if they're concerned about, you know, I don't know, different problems that come up, burnout, you know, like any healthcare profession, homeopaths can get into burnout. They need emotional support from their peers. So it's like a way of building community right into the classroom is having the students work with each other and treat each other as resources. And then another value that we have that we hold very dearly is that one way to be a really good homeopath is to be a very receptive listener, to be able to truly receive the other person in their depth. And that a really good way to do that is to get your own ego out of the way, to get your own projections out of the way, you know, all your own stuff out of the way, so that you can just set yourself aside and really and truly hold that person in your heart. And from my own experience of meditating, I've been meditating actually for more than 30 years now, with a teacher from India named Sri Chinmoy, who teaches a heart center based meditation. I teach that to the students, and we have a meditation at the beginning and end of every class, and it both sets the tone for the class. It helps people to be very focused. It actually helps them learn better, helps them consolidate and assimilate their learning at the end. And we're also encouraging people in many ways to do their own personal growth work or their own spiritual work. One thing I like about Sri Chinmoy is that he feels there are many different ways of spirituality that are valid, kind of paralleling what we're saying about homeopathy. So we encourage the students to have whatever is meaningful for them in the way of personal growth work, self-awareness work, spiritual work, being on some kind of a spiritual journey as a way to become a better human being, and in that way to become a better healer, because we can learn how to step aside and really be of service to our patients, really become the instrument for the healing of our patients in a very humble way, you know, putting our own egos aside and just letting some kind of higher force or higher consciousness work through homeopathy, which is such a beautifully, highly evolved healing art. So those are just some of the ways that we, you know, put these values into the classroom.
You see the meditation helps the students to learn better?
Yeah, it's actually amazing. I learned that from Joel, and I was totally surprised. I never would have thought of doing this, even though I've been teaching meditation for about 25 years now. But Joel would lead a meditation in the beginning of a class of mostly non-meditators. People would become very silent, very focused. Doing it in the beginning of a class lets people put aside, like, all the, you know, people go through so much stress to get to class on time, and everybody has stuff at home that they're dealing with, and then there's traffic on the way and different junk that they kind of walk into the room with, their personal junk, all the stuff that it took them to get there. and you put them into a meditation and they become totally present. Their minds become very still and very focused. In my own meditations that I lead, I ask them to focus on their heart chakra, to open their hearts, and to feel like they'll really be learning by heart. Because I talk about homeopathy from the heart, this relatively simple way of focusing on the most effective way of practice, beginning with the well-known Polycrest, you know, not getting too lost in the forest of the thousands of new remedies that are coming out, but saying in the beginning, let's just learn the well-known Polycrest, let's not make it too complicated, we want you to have a sense of mastery, practice homeopathy from the heart, there's so much good you can do with these simple basic remedies. Then when we meditate at the end, I think of, before I used to meditate at the end of a class, I would often leave a homeopathic seminar feeling completely drained, like my head was totally stuffed with information like a little sausage. I'd have so much information that I would then bring to my office, and it would end up in a notebook somewhere or in my computer, never printed out, never really integrated or consolidated. And instead, when we have a meditation at the end, it's like assimilating, giving the students a chance to just take a deep inhale, exhale, you know, just be still with their learning and letting whatever is the most important sink in so that, again, they can really learn by heart. And that's kind of the pole star, I would say, of the classroom is the sense of heart. Centering in the heart chakra, learning by heart, using the simplicity of the heart, and from the heart, having an attitude of service to our fellow human beings and an attitude of gratitude for this, I feel, a very great privilege and blessing of learning homeopathy.
Lovely words, Bhagavati.
Thank
really
you.
Very nice. You know, I just wanted some clarification for those people who are on the call, because you mentioned that, and I really appreciate this, the idea of, you know, the fact that we do practice differently and there's many different ideas about there in homeopathy, and we do need to create a spirit of community, and, you know, I want to acknowledge all of those. But at the same time, if you could just, because, you know, there are people out there who to say that they're practicing homeopathy and they may be using a radionics machine, or they may be a polypharmacist, you know, who gives seven remedies at the same time.
Yeah.
Could you just tell us what are the boundaries of your school? I mean, like, what do you consider homeopathy, and what do you, I mean, because again, you know, anything can be called homeopathy at a certain
sure.
point. So what do you actually do in your school? What, how do you form the boundaries of that?
Sure. Well, we have two different two-year programs. The students would normally begin with our two-year professional program, which is very Hahnemanian. You know, we teach the Organon and we teach Kent. The students learn how to use the repertory. They learn the grand old Polycrest, which are like the great oak trees with the many spreading branches that can treat so many different conditions, you know. And they learn a very classical approach to, you know, looking for some mental emotional rubrics, learning about some generals and looking at the chief complaint and so forth. So in the first 2 years, it's pretty much a beautifully classical approach. And in the second 2 years, we continue that and we open up some, just because we acknowledge the fact that some people are, you know, kind of pushing the envelope of that a little. By the third year, we're incorporating some ideas from Scholten, and again, not taking them at face value, but really challenging them, allowing the students to use their critical thinking and say, does this really hold up in terms of the provings and in terms of clinical experience? And then by the fourth year, we're introducing some of the ideas of Shankaran, partly because he has some very useful case-taking tips. You know, there's some very useful approaches to case-taking that we can learn from Shankaran, and of course from his wife, Divya Chabra, who has this wonderful approach to case-taking. So we're mostly pretty much 90% within the classical tradition, and then acknowledging on the horizon Scholten and Shankaran. But we don't, like you would say, we don't do radionics or polypharmacy
right.
or anything like that.
And actually, I get that chance to see that, because I know you went over proving in the class, and you asked the students to critically evaluate that proving to see, you know, what was the merit of it. And I thought that was very impressive.
Right. We took a new proving that had been done within the past 2 years. We had all of the proving information, and without showing the students what the master prover, the person who published the proving, she had come up with some particular themes, I asked the students to come up with their own themes. Once they had thought it through for themselves, I had them compare with what it had been published. And it really, I think, gave us all pause to think, like, where did these published things come from? Because for some of them, we really couldn't see a basis in the proving symptoms. We really couldn't see where they had come from. So again, I think really empowering the students to think for themselves.
Yeah, I really like that a lot.
That's and to true. Think critically about the new provings. At the same time, that I'm very grateful for the people who do these provings and come up with all this great information. The information is there. We may decide to extract different themes from it.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
I can see we're running short on time here, so is there anything else you'd like to share with us before I open it up to the other people listening in?
I guess the contact information for the school.
Yes. Well, is there anything before that? Because I'm going to ask you about that.
Okay,
anyway.
Good. Okay, fine. Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to share with us, or do you want to?
I'd be happy to have questions.
Okay, great. So let me just, your website is www.teleosisschool. I'm going to spell that out for everybody. It's www.teleosis, which is T as in Tom, E-L-E-O, S as in Sam, I-S. So teleosis, all lowercase, and then the word school, S-C-H-O-O-L.org. And that's all lowercase altogether. So www.teleosisschool.org. And if they want to call a phone number, is there a good number they can call?
Yeah, it's 617-547-8500.
Great. Is there anything else you want to tell anybody about the school before we open up for general questions?
We'd love to have people come into the clinical program who may have done another excellent foundational classroom program and want to have the chance to put their, to put it into practice, because it's a pretty unique clinical program that it meets one weekend a month, September through June in Boston. So we really welcome transfer students. It's mostly
a good idea, because a lot of schools don't have clinics.
Exactly.
That's a very good idea.
So we feel it's a great offering to the homeopathic community to provide this kind of clinical training, which, by the way, now the CHC is requiring a certain number of hours of both observation, supervision, and so forth. We're really trying to work with them to provide exactly what they're asking for, so that when students graduate from our program, they will have met the requirements for the CHC, which, again, is a little difficult to meet otherwise.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, well, great. Let me open it up to the audience. Hold on. Anybody there who would like to ask a question? Go ahead. Any questions? We have a silent audience.
Hey, Bhagavati, this is Karen Allen. I was just wanted to say hi and to say thanks for the information that you presented. And I think that the concept of building a community is one that is so needed at the time that students are learning things, because they're sure as heck going to need that community once they're done.
Yeah.
So I'm really glad that you have that focus with the school.
Yeah.
So, Karen, nice to have you on the call. Do you have a question you'd like to ask?
I don't.
No? Okay.
But I want to just, for people may not know who Karen is. Karen is the former head of the CHC and still working very closely with it. I'm not sure what your title is at this point, Karen, but
I'm the vice president.
Vice president.
I'm
yeah.
the almost head.
Yeah.
And Leah Bello is now the president of the CHC, and she's doing a fantastic job.
Yeah. So it's really an honor to have Karen. Karen and I have been talking a lot about how we can make the school really serve this goal of creating the CHC as the foundation for a profession of homeopathy. It was something that's another value that the school really supports, is that we like the idea of having homeopathy as a really respected profession that can take pride of place among the other medical professions that mostly require many more hours of both classroom and supervision time than homeopathy currently requires. We think the CHC is an excellent minimum requirement, and I think we feel pretty strongly that that should be the basis for practice, rather than kind of the Wild West approach that anybody can do it with any amount of training, which I think kind of undermines any sense of homeopathy as a serious profession. I mean, you wouldn't want to say anybody could practice surgery with any amount of training that they've had, or, you know what I mean? So we endorse the CHC as what we feel is the basis for the evolving profession of homeopathy.
Well, thanks for that. That's excellent.
Yeah.
Well, we have time for one more question. We just got a couple of more minutes. Does anybody have one final question that they'd like to ask Bhagavati before we get off?
Yeah, I do. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay.
Are you calling from Australia?
No.
Okay.
I'm not clear. Do you teach various ways of looking at a case? I mean, do you understand what I'm saying?
I can't quite hear you. Did you say do we
have... The question was the God, but can you hear me?
Yeah.
Do you teach various ways of looking at a case? Like, I guess she's asking if you're looking at different case analysis strategies. Do you look at it just strictly from, like, the strange, rare, and peculiars? Do you look at the themes? Do you use family information? How do you teach homeopathy?
I'm so glad that you asked that, because, yes, we have a case analysis form that we have the students fill out, and it asks them to solve the same case in at least three different ways. And it's interesting that with the different ways, you sometimes come up with different remedies. So then they do a remedy differential choosing, and they have to justify why they chose to follow one particular analysis strategy. So one analysis strategy, of course, is a repertorization. And then another one is looking for keynotes. And another one is what we call the essence, which would mean that could incorporate basically anything that's not easily repertorizable that you know about the case. And that in some cases it could be, you recognize themes of, say, the snake family or of drug remedies, or it could be that, in some cases, it could be a very strong etiology. That's another analysis strategy, is the never well since. We emphasize that in some cases, or a miasmatic approach. And we teach the students that, you know, certain cases will ask for a different type, a particular type of analysis. You know, some cases are obviously very miasmatic. Other cases have a very strong never well since that kind of has stamped the whole evolution of the case. So we do encourage them to solve each case just as a student exercise. You know, they don't have to do this, of course, once they get out into the real world. But as an exercise, to try solving the same case from several different points of view, and then to also think about, for this particular case, which one is the most valid way to solve it and to really justify that. So it's a good exercise to go through.
Bhagavad, you mentioned miasms. Do you, you mostly focus on the traditional 3 to 4 or perhaps
the five? The original, well, yes, 4 plus cancer, yes.
Yeah, and do you, have you been working at all with the newer mya, the typhoid, malaria, those new miasms, acute, leprosy? Have you been working?
I haven't personally. I use Luke DeShepherd's book, Hahnemann Revisited, and I think he does a really excellent job of summarizing the 5 more traditional miasms.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And for myself, I have found that very effective. And at some point, I'm planning on learning the Shankaran miasms. I really haven't yet. And, you know, I think that we're kind of pushed into learning something new when we reach a point where things aren't working in our practice. And I feel very lucky, I guess. I'm very blessed in my practice that, in general, the relatively simple things that I do generally get really good results. So I'm very blessed. I feel very lucky. And so at this point, I do relatively simple things, and I try to teach the students relatively simple things. And one of them is a relatively simple miasmatic analysis, which I have found very powerful and very effective. I know some people don't pay any attention to miasms, and I have found in some cases that it is a really effective and very helpful way to understand a case. And it can really, you know, using the no-sota, the miasm can really unlock a case in certain instances.
Well, Bhagavati, thank you.
Yeah.
This is a wonderful call.
Yeah.
Let me just reiterate, for those of you who would like to find out more about teleosis, they can go to the website www.teleosis, which is T-E-L-E-O-S-I-S, and then the word school.org. So www.teleosis.org. school.org, and the phone number is 617-547-8500. Let me unmute the lines, and if everyone can give Bhagavati a big thank you.
Bhagavati, thank you.
Thank you very much. It was wonderful.
Thank you very much.